To thank you for making Subway footlongs famous, now enjoy any regular footlong as a $5 footlong. That's right, any, including your favorites, like the savory chicken and bacon ranch. Any Subway regular footlong is just $5. Hurry in.
The BS Report is a free-flowing conversation that occasionally touches on mature subjects.
First of all,
this is the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
It might be cool, I don't know. And if it's not, I don't care.
The BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Bill Simmons works for ESPN. He's also named the sports guy, and he writes a comical sports column. He must be a popular dude.
The BS Report.
It's got a real dirty sound, like a rusty steak knife cutting through a well-aged steak.
Now.
Here's Bill Simmons.
Welcome to the BS Report. Hope you're recovering from March Madness. We're doing a little baseball today. Bringing in Jonah Carey, who writes for so many publications that if I listed all of them, we'd run out of time. But he's on the Subway Fresh Tech Hotline. What's happening?
Bill, I was just in Amsterdam. I picked up the WMDs. I'm ready to go.
Excellent. Right now you're writing for Wall Street Journal, Bloomberg Sports. You used to write for Page Two.
I did. I wrote for Page Two for a couple of years. Went on to do a bunch of other stuff and writing a book and just.
You're writing a book about the Tampa Bay Devil Rays.
I
still call them the Devil Rays.
You just can't find $1, by the way. Andrew Friedman is going to send you a.
I don't care.
All right, that's good.
Yeah. I don't like name changes. I just, they're the Devil Rays to me. You can't, like, just chop off half of them. I don't like it.
Well, they changed their name after 2007 season, and they immediately beat the Yankees, beat the Red Sox, and won the pennant. So, I mean, there's something going on there. I don't know.
Whatever. AL East. Let's talk about AL East first, because for the Devil Rays, this does feel like, and we see this happen in baseball sometimes with the medium and small market teams, where they're kind of all in, and they have a whole bunch of prospects on the horizon. But they have Crawford leaving after this year, Carlos Pena leaving after this year. How do you see the season progressing for them?
I think they're in good shape. You know, it's going to depend. A lot of things have to go right, right? I mean, if they suffer one big injury or they have something happen like with Pat Burrow last year where he was freaking awful, then that's going to be a big problem for them because the Yankees and the Rays and the Sox can adjust. They can pick up a $10 million guy at the deadline. They can kind of do whatever they want to do. So with the Rays, things have to go right. And, you know, J.P. Howell's already hurt for them. So there are those things in play. But, you know, assuming they're around at the deadline, it's not like they're going to just sell Crawford and Pena and Rafael Soriano and all those guys. They're going to go for it. I do agree that this is an all-in season. I mean, the owner even said we're going to drop our payroll by $20 million next year. So this is their chance. They have a lot of guys in the right spot. And, you know, even after they lose some of those veterans, they're still in good shape. They still have Evan Longoria and David Price and B.J. Upton. So they'll contend for a long time. They're built to last.
And they have their top two prospects they just sent down. But Jennings and Hellickson? That's his name, right? Yeah, the pitcher. And those guys can come up there in the middle of the season. Jennings, I'm very familiar with because he's on my fantasy team, and I've been following him. I followed him all last year, and I'm very excited. And kind of secretly hoping that Carl Crawford wrecks his knee in a warning track or something so I can bring him up. But he could come up mid-season. So potentially they could trade Crawford for a piece that could help them this year and a prospect or whatever, and then just bring Jennings up and put him in there, right?
The only thing that I would say is that it's hard to find, and you can make the case in any sport, by the way, football, basketball, it's hard to find these really great challenge trades where one good guy gets traded for another good guy and they could both help each other right away. In fact, the best example that I could think of was probably the Rays did it when they traded Delmon Young coming off a really good rookie season, and they got Matt Garza and Jason Bartlett, who ultimately kind of helped them win the pennant. But it's rare. It's very rare. I don't know that they could trade Crawford and get, you know, Wandy Rodriguez. I just don't know if that kind of thing would happen. I think more likely scenario is Matt Joyce is the right fielder right now. He's a pretty good young player, but we don't know how it's going to go. There's a very good possibility that Jennings could be a better bet than Joyce right now, in which case they could just call Jennings up and do it that way, keep Crawford, try to win the pennant, offer Crawford arbitration after the season, and collect the compensatory draft picks, just go in that direction.
What's the ceiling for Crawford? Has he already hit it?
He's right there. I mean, he's, what, I think 28 now, so, I mean, he's a guy who's in his prime. There's some power upside, I think. You're looking at a guy who steals a lot of bases and does a lot of things well, gets on base and all that good stuff. But, you know, you never know. When players come up, there's always a tendency to think about when they're going to hit their prime. You can make the case it's a little later in baseball. We've seen a lot of guys peak at later ages for a whole variety of reasons. But, you know, in the case of Crawford, maybe he will get to that point where he's hitting 15, 20 home runs more consistently, which would be, I think, the one thing that he could add to his game. So it's possible.
And he's one of those, he's like one of those good clubhouse leader guys, right?
The guy works like an animal. There was a great piece on, I think it was on Baseball Tonight, or maybe E60, one of those, and talked all about Crawford and just how he's in there and he's working really hard. He's a really fast guy, but he's something like 6'2", 225. He's real, real strong, too, and a quiet guy. I don't know that he has the reputation that he should. I think, let's say if his skin pigmentation was a little bit different, I think he would get a little bit more credit than maybe he does.
Mm. And he's the kind of athlete that baseball is just not really getting anymore, which makes him interesting because, first of all, African-American, a speed power guy. Those guys seem to be gravitating toward football and basketball and have been for, I don't know, 10, 12 years. Do you feel that changing? Can, like in the minor leagues, is that starting to shift or is it getting worse?
Well, I think if you look at the Rays, they're a team that specifically goes out and targets guys like that. They say, these guys are great athletes. Let's seduce them with money. I mean, you know, if they're going to go to whatever, Texas or Florida and play college football, they can't get, maybe they'd get some money, but they can't get the kind of money they could get for a professional baseball team. So, you know, from that standpoint, they were able to get a guy like Crawford. B.J. Upton is like that, too, by the way.
Yeah.
And Jennings has maybe not quite as much power, but he is that all-around kind of athlete. If they put those three guys in the outfield, there would be zero triples hit against the Tampa Bay Rays. They're thoroughbreds. They're unbelievable. So I hope that baseball gets guys like that. My favorite player of all time, I'm a Montreal Expos fan, was Tim Raines. And, I mean, he just embodied that. Him and Ricky in the 80s and 90s were phenomenal to watch. These guys did everything. They had power, they had speed, they got on base, they were exciting. I mean, it's just much more fun to watch a guy like that than a guy who just comes up there, strikes out 150 times, walks 100, and hits 40 home runs. Not that the 40 home run guy doesn't have value, I just think aesthetically it's a lot better. I agree with you about those all-around types.
Now, so Tim Raines, your favorite, you grew up an Expos fan. Tim Raines, your favorite guy growing up. And you're also somebody that incorporates statistics and all this, the writing that you do. Tim Raines, one of the all-time ahead of his time statistics guys. Correlation?
Yeah, I think you can make that case. And I think that because he's underrated, I could sort of say yes and no to that. Because, I mean, I became a Raines fan when I was, I don't know, eight. So I don't know that. I was reading Bill James at a very young age, but not quite that young. So
maybe right.
You could make the case that it was there was some aesthetic value at first. But as time went on, certainly, and I think that when the Hall of Fame debate gets revved up, for instance, Raines does not get enough credit. I mean, I know that you're a Sox guy, and I know that you're probably happy that Rice got into the Hall of Fame. Tim Raines is a better player than Jim Rice. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Raines did more things really well. He just played in a much smaller market. His talents were a little bit more subtle, things like drawing walks and stealing bases at a high rate. These are harder things to quantify, and for a lot of Hall of Fame voters, it just sort of close their eyes, and they say, either this guy was feared, or this guy hit 500 home runs, and they kind of call it a day at that. So he should definitely be in the Hall. I'm a big, big believer in that. I have a Tim Raines advocacy site for the Hall of Fame, Raines30.com. I mean, that's, you know, with, managed with a bunch of other Raines fanatics, and we're so determined to see this guy get in, we think he's getting short shrift right now.
This has been his best decade, even though he retired. I don't even know when, but I remember when I was really into what-if sports before they changed the engine too much, you know, and the real value were like the OBP speed guys. Tim Raines was like a god. Like, I feel like that should be part of his Hall of Fame candidacy was how he translated to Stratomatic and computer baseball and stuff. And now what's interesting is those guys were translating to those things before the GMs kind of started incorporating it. And now I think, like, you know, if he had GMs from now that were in the 80s, Tim Raines' value would have been, like, twice as much.
Oh, you know, no doubt. And I think that you're seeing that with current GMs now where they're recognizing. I mean, you have guys like Theo Epstein and guys like Andrew Friedman and John Daniels and some of these younger types. And maybe they grew up in that era and they understand it a little bit better. They watch these guys. There's no doubt in my mind that some of them played Stratomatic or What If Sports or APBA or any of that stuff. And they're getting it. I mean, you know, this stuff goes. Branch Rickey was talking about on-base percentage in the 40s.
Yeah.
I just think there was this long period where people kind of forgot about it and said, whatever, home runs, RBIs, and that's it. And I'm not a zealot one way or another. I think that, you know, there's a lot of ways that you can see a good player, but I just think that that is certainly one way that even though we have the Moneyball revolution and there's stats for everything and all that stuff, when it comes to actually making a decision about a real-life player, that gets lost. I agree about Raines. You could go to, you know, Jimmy Winn with the Houston Astros, was a terrific player back in the day who had that kind of skill set. There are guys, I mean, even, you know, in current baseball that I think just are a little bit underrated from that standpoint, even though we've come a long way statistically.
Kent Singleton was another one.
He was another
somebody you never, you never thought of him when he was playing, but then you look back at his stats and he was just banging out the high OBPs every year. And
Rusty
always,
Staub is another one, by the way.
Yeah, I remember, you know, in Boston in the '80s with Boggs, there was real resentment toward him because, you know, second and first, ninth inning, he would work a walk over trying to knock the guy in second base in, and we all hated him for it. But now it's like, you know, that's actually the better percentage play. Like, he was another guy that we just didn't appreciate, I think, fully.
Well, but the best clutch hitter, whatever, in our era or whatever, whoever that is, he's going to fail 6 times out of 10. I mean, the odds are against you coming up with it anyway. So I think that's the case. The thing that got me, and I followed the Red Sox somewhat also growing up because I grew up in Montreal, so we would get, like, the Burlington, Vermont feed of the Sox. I watched a bunch of games with Dewey Evans and Jim Rice and all those guys. Was Boggs would bat leadoff. And I think that people in Boston were a little bit mystified by that because this was not Ricky. This was not a guy who had tremendous speed. They were sort of like, I don't get it. And in fact, I guess the Sox were way ahead of their time doing that. Now we're seeing that where it's not necessarily the guy who's the fastest who might be batting one or two. It's the guy who just gets on base all the time.
Yeah, nobody really could figure that out. I guess that, you know, in Boston's defense, we didn't have like the typical speed guy that a lot of teams had. So they were like, well, why not just put him there? He always gets on base. People kind of talked themselves into it, but it still seemed like really, really out there and crazy. And
Artie
now you look back.
Your alternative. Yeah, that was so good.
So the Tampa guy, Friedman.
Yes.
Do you think it's more fun to run a team like Tampa where you're basically walking a tightrope? And, like, for instance, you make the Pat the Bat trade and it doesn't work out and you've just annihilated 12% of your payroll or whatever it is and there's no bouncing back, whereas Theo Epstein makes a mistake, and it's like, all right, well, I'll just do something else. And you just, Julio Lugo, oh, that didn't work out. I'll just get somebody else. I almost think it would be more fun to run a team like Tampa.
I think that's sort of, maybe from intellectually that's true, but these guys are still, you know, they have the same goals as we do as fans. They just still want to win the World Series. And so, you know, Friedman knows that he's at somewhat of a disadvantage there. But
it's more challenging. You're being challenged more intellectually and professionally, I think, running a team like Tampa. Like, you cannot mess up. I think ultimately Theo always has that, I'm trying to think, like the circus. What do they call the thing on the bottom?
The safety net.
Theo always can fall on the safety net and just get up and go back up and climb back up there. But in Tampa, you can't do that. Every move has to be carefully, methodically planned out.
I always like the reference to the Boston Red Sox and the surrounding environment as a circus, by the way, so well played there.
Thank you.
But, absolutely, I think that's true. And you know, Billy Beane had that right in Oakland, too, where he won all these divisions. And, we're talking about guys that do it with stats, but look at the Minnesota Twins, right? I mean, they've won a bunch of divisions. Now they're spending more money. They just got Joe Mauer and all this stuff. But they're still not what you would call an elite team as far as revenue stream goes, and they've been able to do it relatively on the cheap. The Atlanta Braves have a good revenue stream. I mean, they have a cable deal with TBS and all that stuff, but they won all these divisions, and they were not the Yankees and the Red Sox, too. So maybe there's just more of a sense of accomplishment at the end. It's sort of like, I did it, you know? And the thing about Friedman is, he's got help. I mean, you look at any front office now, and we talk about the general managers, and we say, this guy's the best, or this guy's the worst, or whatever, but really, it's just this group of people, and the Rays have all these guys, you know, guys maybe you haven't heard of who are in their 20s and early 30s, and they're crunching numbers and doing cool stuff, and they all have a vested interest in it. So I think that it's just this team effort. You can't just sort of have one guy making trades and call it a day. You need an army to get this right.
Can you run a baseball team that successfully without that army?
Probably not. I just think there's too much going on. I mean, you've talked about things like having a capologist in football and basketball. They certainly have that in baseball, even though there's no cap, where there are people that are paying attention to salaries and they want to know, is this guy valuable and how much hidden value does he have and all that good stuff. So you're seeing it with every team. It might not always be a group of stat heads. In the case of the Rays, it's actually funny. The guy who's running it is a guy named James Click, also from Baseball Prospectus. There are all these guys from Baseball Prospectus who are now in Major League front offices. Yeah, seriously. The guy for the Cleveland Indians is a guy named Keith Woolner. He was also from Baseball Prospectus. Pittsburgh Pirates have a guy named Dan Fox, also from Baseball Prospectus. They're making real-life decisions. But I think you need a good scouting department. You need all that stuff. It's not like we can turn our back on what's worked in the past because you still need to go out and scout diamonds in the rough. When a guy is 17 or 18 years old, stats don't do you anything. You have to figure out that B.J. Upton projects as a good player, that Dustin Pedroia, despite the fact that he's 5'2", could actually work out in the major leagues.
Yeah, it seems like those are the guys that are always going to fall through the cracks. And I think the same thing goes for basketball. There's always going to be guys that are 2 inches too short or they're 10 pounds too heavy, and ultimately those are the value guys. Because I think in baseball now, they've pushed it so far with all the different ways they can go that, you know, we were talking about this at the Sloan Conference. Like, so what's next? Like, we figured out offense. Now it seems like they're getting pretty close to figuring out defense and how to get the values there. So then what's next? And the feeling was like almost like mental stuff would be the next thing, like breaking down people's brains and what would make one person succeed and another guy fold and how pressure would affect different people. Like, that almost seems like that's going to be the next frontier, and obviously there's no stats for that. So I don't know.
Well, and I think teams are doing that to some extent. You're seeing psychologists, and I know the Reds experimented with stuff like brain typing back in the day, which was sort of interesting, but it was kind of incongruous with the type of front office that they have where they were not really doing things in an innovative way. So, yeah, certainly. And you talked about one thing that you're a big proponent of, I know, is looking at guys' performance in the tournament. And it's not rocket science. If you're beating good teams in the tournament, even if you come from Southwest Nowhere State, there's something to be said for that, and maybe your stock should go up. So what do you do with Omar Samhan, right? This guy, my favorite joke on Twitter is that he looks like a guy that he would wear a T-shirt into the swimming pool, and yet he's scoring 32 points in one of the biggest games of his life in the NCAA tournament. Well, you know, maybe he deserves some credit, and maybe you have to think a guy like that, Maybe Dwan Blair, you know, he's kind of a heavy guy. He's only 6'7". He's not your traditional, whatever, four at the end. He's certainly not a stretch four, but he can be very successful at that level. So, yeah, I think that's true, and that's... There's got to be some scouting eye to it. I think it's a combination of psychological, of having the experience with scouting and maybe recognizing things that you wouldn't. I know you and I are both friendly with Daryl Morey, and what he's done with Chuck Hayes, a 6'6 center, and Battier and all these guys. They're never going to win your fantasy league, but they seem like real good players in real life.
Yeah, well Daryl made the trade for Kevin Martin, which was interesting because it was the first trade where he didn't trust all the data. It was a little more of a people trade and a situation trade than a statistical trade, which I thought was a big step for him because, you know, part of that trade was about, I don't think this guy is in the right situation right now. And if we put him in a different situation with, you know, A, B, C, D, and E factors in his favor and they aren't right now, I think his stats will change. So, you know, I thought that was a good example of a blend between looking at the numbers and the situation of what the guy's in now versus kind of common sense. Maybe that's where we're headed.
I was going to say that I think with Martin, I think what you're looking at there is, and you can make this case in baseball too, if you're a real smart GM and you get all these under the radar guys and you pick up this guy for nothing and he hits you 30 home runs and fine, that's all good. But to get the superstar, you still need something. You still need to either make a big trade, you need to spend money, you need to just have an unbelievable draft pick. And I think that from that standpoint, the Rockets didn't have that guy, right? I mean,
yeah.
Martin isn't necessarily a superstar of the LeBron caliber, but he's a guy that can really fill it up. And maybe that's the hardest thing in the NBA still, that after all these metrics and all that, is to just find a simple guy who can score 25 points a game, the way in baseball you can find a guy who can be, whatever, a 40-home run guy, a guy who's 350 and is just this star. So you could do all this little research and fill all the complimentary roles, but at some point you got to either open your wallet or make a big deal and go out and get the stud, because if you don't, you're probably, you know, you might win a few games, but you're probably not winning an NBA championship or World Series.
In baseball, who are the two or three people, types of people that you cannot win 90 games without?
You know, I think you certainly someone like Pujols. I mean, when you start with a guy like that, it just does a lot for your club. And
the slugger hits 330, maybe 900 plus OPS.
At least, yeah.
You need one of those guys. You cannot win without one of those guys.
I think that's pretty true. And even with the Rays, we say that we did it on the cheap. They did it on the cheap. I mean, Evan Longoria is a beast. You know, he's going to be an MVP candidate for the next 10 or 12 years. By the way, signed to the most team-friendly contract of any player in baseball.
Right.
He's got a 9-year deal for like $40 million, and that includes three options. The first 6 years are, I don't know, $17 million. It's just outrageous, the deal that they signed with him. So, yeah, you need a guy like that. It's very good. If you could fill it up with everything else and have no weaknesses, great. But give me a Pujols, give me a Longoria, you know, give me someone of that ilk, sure.
Because I would say if I was doing a fantasy draft of guys I would want to start a baseball team with, I'd want that one big bopper. And then after that, I think I'd want the two starters who I knew could throw 220 good innings a year. And I'd want two, not one.
I think that's right. And I think from a fantasy standpoint, that actually sets up pretty – I mean, I'm a fantasy nerd myself, and it sets up pretty well that way. You can go and do that. You can get Ryan Braun or Pujols in the first round. And people don't respect pitching as much. I think that the experts, they just say, we're going to wait on pitching until the 95th round and we're going to do this and that. Well, what if you could bracket Lincecum and Halliday or Halliday and Greinke, you know, do something like that. So, yeah, no, that's right. And if you haven't done your draft yet, that actually sets up pretty well for this year, just the way the guys happen to fall on the board from what I've seen. I think that would work.
I don't think the injury component, not just with fantasy but in real baseball, gets factored in enough. We talked about this a little bit at the Sloan weekend, but, you know, like somebody like J.D. Drew. The stat heads love J.D. Drew. And there's even an article in Boston about, J.D. Drew. He's this contract was a success, 900 OPS. And he did, you know, the last 2 years he stayed pretty healthy, I think. I think he's been at like 135 games each year. But the bottom line is he's never going to play more than 135 games and might get hurt, and that number might dip to 110. He can't play against lefties. So with somebody like him with his stats, it's never factored in who the other schmuck who had to come in and play the other 27 to 47 games was. Last year was Rocco Baldelli. He was terrible. And Josh Reddick for a little bit. The durability guys, to me, it doesn't seem like they get accounted for enough. And that's why somebody like John Lester, who I know is going to throw 220, 225 innings this year, to me has become so much more valuable than, I don't know, Rich Harden. Like, right. Rich Harden, like, oh, he's got fantastic stuff. All right, but am I going to get 220 innings out of him? Probably not. You know, yeah. And I think that's, I don't know. I never hear that factored in enough. Or do we have stats for this to factor that?
Well, there's something called wins above replacement, which just basically measures how good the guy is times playing time. So if he's playing 162 games and he's a beast, then he's better than if he plays 135 and he's a beast.
All right, so explain wins above replacement to me. Now, here's a stat that sounds interesting, and I've seen it, but is it like an easy stat for somebody like me to understand?
I think that the way to look at it, with almost any stat, by the way, is don't even worry about the input, just consider what the output is. Basically, the input is a way of looking at everything that he does, offense, defense, base running, and all that, and putting it into wins. How many wins is this guy worth compared to a guy that you could pick up off the street, compared to your Alex Cora type? Okay, fine. So Joe Mauer, Albert Pujols, guys like that, 7 or 8 wins in a season. That is a monster player, a really, really good guy, a guy who should be worth about $25 million on the open market. If you have someone who's worth 3 or 4 wins, that's a pretty solid player. If you have someone who's worth 1 or 2, he's kind of a marginal starter, maybe a backup. And if you have someone who's worth 0, then he probably shouldn't be on your team. You know, it's as simple as that. And so
they factor in injuries with that?
Yes. Well, they factor in, with the projections, they factor in injuries, but really what they're factoring in terms of the calculation is playing time. So it could be an injury. It could be that you got suspended for 50 games because you did something awful. The point is, it's whatever the guy produced in that given season, and it has everything. It adjusts for ballpark. It adjusts for defense, the alignment of the moon, whatever you want. It's got all that stuff.
So how reliable is it then?
Well, I mean, it is reliable because it's not a you know, you could use it to predict things. You could say, well, this guy had this many last year, that's how many he's going to have this year. But just in terms of a real-time account of what happened in a given season, it's reliable. I think that the only thing that I could say is that might surprise you a little bit is the types of players that sometimes it spits out that are more valuable than you might expect. Certainly Pujols and Mauer and guys like that. But, for instance, Ben Zobrist was unbelievably valuable last year. And if you think about it a little bit, it actually makes sense. It just takes a little kind of a second level of thought. It's not just that he's good and he has a high OPS or whatever. He played a bunch of positions. He played a bunch of positions really well. One of them was second base, which is a hard position to find a lot of offense. He was durable. You know, he played all season. He stole bases. He just did absolutely everything really well. And when MVP voting came up, nobody's thinking about Ben Zobrist, but he's fantastic. He was one of the best guys in all of baseball. So definitely reliable. I just think that it opens your eyes a little bit to guys that maybe had that hidden value, one of them being, like you said, durability, certainly.
It's so funny you brought him up because I swear I was going to bring him up, but then you kept going. Because another guy like that is Yukus. Yukus'
right.
ability to play first and third, and they can even throw him in the outfield if they need to. To me, I just think that pushes a guy to a whole other level. And you're right, with Zobrist last year, not only was he gigantic for the Rays, but I know he swung my AL fantasy draft. Somebody had him for $1. And then he's eligible at 5 positions. You can basically push him around. But I think that's one of the reasons why I would not sleep on Evan Turner as the number one pick, because that guy can play 3 positions. And you can basically stick him wherever you want. And for the teams at the top of the NBA draft, that's like a huge luxury. Not just like, oh, I need a shooting guard, I'll put him there, but somebody that, oh, well, when my point guard comes out, we can play him there. Oh, when our small forward comes out, we can play him there. Like, you know, it's almost like the Swiss Army knife thing. And Zobrist was the Swiss Army knife last year.
I would actually argue that those guys are even more valuable, in fact, maybe a lot more valuable in basketball than they are in baseball. Definitely the case in baseball, certainly from a fantasy perspective. But in basketball, you can only have 5 guys on the court at any given time, and they're interacting with each other. If a ground ball's hit to second base, Zobrist is either there or he's not. But if Turner's on the court, that affects how your stretch four is doing and how your center's doing and how your small four, everybody on the court is affected by everybody else. And because of that versatility, not just on offense, but really on defense, I mean, this whole idea of you draft guys that can guard different positions, like Cephalosia. I mean, you know, talk about a hidden value guy that the Zombie Sonics go out and get.
Yeah.
And he, you know, is just this very effective guy. He doesn't have Turner's offensive skill, but he can do everything because he's kind of long and lean and he's quick and he's all this stuff. So those guys are hugely, hugely valuable in basketball. I think more so than baseball. Just you have to have several guys like that if you want to compete in today's NBA.
Question on the defensive stats. So I get it for a team like Seattle. You know, that's a team that doesn't have a gigantic payroll. They got the kind of ballpark where defense becomes, you know, really important. And it's a way for them to kind of cut corners, get some value guys. Like, it totally makes sense to me. It's going to jump them potentially from 80 wins to 90. Who knows? Do a team like the Red Sox need to give a crap about this? I mean, don't they have the money to just basically get whoever they want? Do they need to go with something that's a little bit of a gimmick?
The thing that I would say about defense and about anything in baseball is that there are a lot of ways to win games. It seems simple to just say, let's go get 9 guys who hit 40 home runs and call it a day. If you literally had 9 guys who hit 40 home runs, I'm pretty sure you'd win the pennant, but it's hard to do that. And I think the defense, it's not that I think, I know, defense is just another way to win games. You could argue that it's a gimmick or whatever, but the fact is, if you're a good defender, then you save runs. If you're a good hitter, then you produce runs. I mean, it's just different sides of the same coin. I will say that because of that ballpark, especially left field, I think could be a little bit misleading, and maybe center to a certain extent, but definitely left, you know. I don't know that there are metrics that properly measure how Yaz was in his prime or Rice or Mike Greenwell or any other left fielders they had about bounces off the monster and things like that. There are certain position things that are hard to account for. But I'll tell you something. Up the middle, definitely at second base and shortstop, I'm a huge believer in that stuff. I think that if you're talking about a guy, look at Jimmy Rollins last year. Jimmy Rollins had a miserable offensive season. He couldn't get on base to save his life. He was way, way down from his levels that he had a few years before when he was the MVP. But the guy was still very valuable because everything that was hit toward him or anywhere near him, he not only made a play, he could potentially turn that into a double play and get 2 outs out of 0. I mean,
right.
That's just huge. All of a sudden, and it's not just that it shows up on the scoreboard. It has what you would call a cascading effect. Let's say Lester's pitching. It's a 6th inning. It's a tight jam. He's getting tired and all this stuff, and Scudero comes in, and he ranges to his right, and he makes a tremendous play, and he throws to Pedroia for one on to first double play. Now Lester's going into the 7th. Now you've got a chance to bring Bard in the 8th, Papelbon in the 9th. Good night, Red Sox win. That stuff really, really matters. If anything, I would say maybe it's not measured enough on the pitching side, the value that a defender can bring.
I've talked myself into what they did because, for you know, I really feel like they had a real plan this year. And
yep.
Yeah, I think it's one thing to say, I'm just going to do the gimmick. We got to do defense, whatever. But, you know, I think it was a short-term and a long-term plan. The short-term was that, hey, we got to maintain some flexibility for 2011, 2012 to maybe go get Maurer, who's now off the market, or whoever. But they also wanted to do the short-term part of, we need to bring some guys in right now and come up with some sort of identity for the 2010 season. I actually feel like they did that. And initially, I wasn't crazy about it, but I think it was just selfishly because I don't think it's that much fun to watch a 3-hour 2-1 game. So as a fan, I'm not sure I'm that excited about it. But I think as a plan for this, as a strategic plan for the season, it's probably the Red Sox over under is 94.5. I'd be amazed if this team didn't win 95 games. Just
yeah,
they're
very
set
well
up.
Set up. Yeah, all the forecasting systems are very bullish on the Red Sox, and it's for that reason, and it's because they're going to do everything well. I mean, I guess the one fear, and this has been written in a lot of places, and I've talked about it a little bit, it's that they don't have this guy that puts the fear of God into you. You know, that maybe it was Bay to some extent last year, but certainly when Poppy was in his prime, certainly when Manny was in his prime, you know, who is going to be that guy? The question is, does that matter or not? It, you know, you, aesthetically, again, it matters as a fan, and oh, Manny's coming up, Poppy's coming up, we're definitely going to win here. But, like, if Drew draws a walk and, you know, Cameron hits a seeing-eye single through the hole and they win the game that way, that still counts. Maybe there's no Blair Witch videos of David Ortiz and it's a home run and people are freaking out, but
yeah.
It still counts. And I think that the Sox are going to do it. I agree with you. I don't know it's going to be as, oh, my God, they're the Sox. But, you know, if they win the World Series, nobody's going to really care.
I have a couple issues. Well, first of all, last year's Red Sox season was the most boring I can remember that they've had. Probably all decade. It's just there was not one person where I was excited when the guy was up. You know, which, again, that's selfish and being a selfish fan. But, I was imagining, like, living in Boston, you always used to have the Manny test of, oh, I can't go get a hot dog right now. Manny's coming up the next inning. There wasn't one guy in the team you felt that, oh, I'll get a hot dog right now. What do you care? Like, who are you going to miss? So I think that's an issue. The other issue is that I do think when it gets to October and you have some, you know, you need to have those two or three guys that are just going to be impossible to get out, or guys you can trust and know they're going to come through. And to think of, like, I don't know, somebody like Mike Cameron coming up in a gigantic spot in the eighth inning in Yankee Stadium when we're down 4-3 and Rivera's looming, he's warming up, and we need a hit, and I'm relying on Mike Cameron. I don't feel good about that.
Well, Mike Cameron is your number eight guy. I mean, I think.
Well, I'm just saying. You know what I mean? It's, we have. I guess I trust Victor. I like Victor.
I mean, Euclid too. You just
trust Euclid.
Victor are your guys. Pedroia, to some extent, is your guy. Those are the Manny Poppy Bay of the past. It's just they profile.
Wow. You can't compare
they're not
them.
The same.
Yeah.
They're not the same, but how hard is it to get Euclid out? Euclid might not hit a grand slam, but can he hit a single? Yeah, probably. And if you need a single, you're in good shape. But can he hit a double? Yeah, certainly. You know, so. And I think that your point about excitement is a good point, and I think that goes more to the farm system than anything else. Just close your eyes for a second. Imagine you're a fan of a different team. Who are the most exciting guys? To me, they're the young guys. You know, I'm really excited about Justin Upton. If I was an Arizona Diamondbacks fan, oh, my God, this guy's 21. He could hit 9 million home runs and steal 9 million bases, and he's just cool. He's got the swagger about him. You know, I think if it's a pitcher, I think of Greinke or Lincecum. These guys are phenomenal, and they're young. They're going to be good for many years. That, to me, is a function of the farm system. The Red Sox have produced good players, but have they produced those one or two guys that's like, holy cow. I guess Lester, you know, Euclid and Pedroia and Lester, they're all homegrown. They're all very good. Maybe you can make the case of Lester being kind of that amazing excitement guy, but, I still think that when we're talking about the type of player I think you're talking about, that's a little bit missing just in the way that they drafted and developed players. Doesn't mean that they haven't been good. Doesn't mean they haven't been successful. But for whatever reason, they either haven't tried to or haven't yet developed a guy who really reminds you of Greinke or Justin Upton, one of those players.
They had a good run early on in the Theo reign. In the last couple of years, they've had guys that, talking up big time, who really they haven't really hit a home run with that many of them. Which, you know, this is part of the Boston's big plan, was we're going to throw so much money in the farm system and Asia and, you know, the South America, all these different places. And when you look at, like, the top 100 prospects, Westmoreland was their best guy, and now he had brain surgery. Like, who knows where he stands? And then I guess the other one is Casey Kelly. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly not when you compared to a team like the Rays. The Rays are just, they're overflowing with guys. And I don't know. I'm worried about the Rays. I mean, I just think that when you go into this decade that's coming up, you look at the Rays, the young guys that they have, and then you look at the Yankees, who are just built to, you know, it's a freaking juggernaut. I don't know where the Red Sox fit in with this next decade. I think it would be really solid. But if you had to bet on World Series appearances between those three teams, wouldn't the Red Sox have the longest odds possibly?
It's close. I mean, I think that the Yankees...
Yankees would have best odds.
Yeah, the thing about the Yankees is that they've always had money, but they used to spend it really badly. They used to be like the Orioles and the Mets and the Dodgers back in the day, that they were a rich team that didn't do it right, and they've just been much better. Cashman, I really don't think he gets enough credit. I know that, you know, maybe you can kind of scoff at it and say, oh, he's got $200 million, I can do anything I want with $200 million. But look, I mean, the Red Sox don't have $200 million. They have a lot, and they're not always the best team. And even the Yankees, I mean, for a while, were not the best team when they had the most money. So I think there's that. The thing about the Sox that I would say is they might have fewer guys that really, you know, are just like, oh my God, A-Rod's coming up, or oh my God, Evan Longoria's coming up, but they don't have any weaknesses. And there's a lot to be said for that in baseball. If you can go 1-9 and put up a pretty decent at bat, if you can go through your whole bullpen, you know, 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, into extra innings and have guys, depth everywhere, bench depth, all this stuff, that matters a lot. I go back to a lot of ways to win in baseball. You know, one way is to have a lot of speed, one way is to have a lot of power, and another way is to just not be really bad at anything. And I feel that way about the Sox. We talked about homegrown guys, Lester, Pedroia, Papelbon, Euclid, Ellsbury, Bard. Are any of these guys the most exciting player in baseball? No way, but they have a lot of them, and there's just no position that you could say the Red Sox really suck at X. And so I think that kind of matters.
I would say this is this is probably the biggest year they've had in terms of what unfolds this season will set up like the next five. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Not only the closer situation, how that goes, I think they're the logical team that's going to make a move on Adrian Gonzalez if he becomes available, or whoever, whatever big name guy. They've set themselves up to take a chance on one huge guy, and then they have this Papelbon-Bard issue. They have the, it seems like they're going to keep Buchholz at this point. The Dice K thing they're getting out of when? Pretty soon? Is it next year?
Was it a 5-year contract? So,
oh, God. It's just one end.
Well, it was all the posting money. That was a killer. That's why it ended up being 9 figures.
Well, they can't trade him either. You know, like, if they could trade him,
yeah,
he'd actually be a pretty valuable trade piece because his actual salary is only, like, I think, $8 million.
It's something like that. It's escalating, but I think you're about right, yeah.
Yeah, which is, you know, if you're the Kansas City Royals and you put him in some small market or, you know, whatever, that's pretty valuable. But they can't trade him, unfortunately, and I doubt he'd want to go anywhere. He's the national treasure has not really been a treasure for the Red Sox. What did you think of the Maurer contract? Were you surprised?
No, not surprised. I mean, I knew that they were going to do something, and I think it goes to what's happened in Minnesota over the last few years. I mean, being an Expos fan, I can remember back in the day, and the Twins were supposed to be the other team that was going to get contracted along with the Expos. And to think that we've gone from that to, oh, look, they just gave their star player $184 million within a span of 8 years, that's pretty crazy. And a lot of that just has to do with, honestly, goodwill of taxpayers. The fact that you're willing to shell out $500 million in taxpayer money and go build a shiny new stadium, that's who paid for it. It's the guy who lives in St. Paul. You know, it's the truck driver who lives in Minneapolis. Those are the people paying Joe Maurer's salary. Sometimes we say that's sort of true in the case of ticket, you know, buying tickets. It's literally true. That's how they built the stadium. That's how they got the revenue. And, you know, you could argue one way or another about whether billionaires should have other people building stadiums for them. But the fact is, if you're a baseball fan in Minnesota, it's pretty awesome. Not only is he a great player, but he's the face of the franchise. There's a credibility issue, too. You know, maybe Jim Thome and Orlando Hudson, who were signed for nothing and are pretty quality players, maybe they don't go to Minnesota if they don't have Maurer or Morneau or some of guys like that. So I think that you can make a case that it's not quite overpaying, but it's certainly not a hometown discount. I think you're paying kind of full value for an elite player, and there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, if you think about the Yankees, are we ever going to begrudge them? Well, you'd begrudge them because you're a Sox fan, but would you begrudge them for signing Teixeira or Sebastian? Of course not. You'd say, they're the best. We're going to go get them, and the Twins did that. They acted very much like the Yankees did, and that's good. It's good to see teams that are not the Yankees or the Sox going out and making those kinds of investments.
Yeah, I actually get mad when the Red Sox fans whine about all the money that the Yankees get to spend because, you know, from 04 and 07, it's not like we were paupers.
Right.
We were in the top three. So it's like, oh, yeah, we did the same thing. So I'm looking at Joe Maurer right now. He's played 699 games in 6 seasons.
Mm-hmm.
They just signed him for a crap load of money. 8 years, no trade, $184 million. Catcher, the toughest position really to predict the longevity, the wear and tear, all that stuff. Odds they regret this deal in about 3-4 years.
I think there's at least a 40% chance. Definitely not foolproof. I've discussed it with smart people like Dave Cameron and some other people who write about stuff like this, and it can go either way. I think that you have to be careful how you're managing this guy. If you see him slipping even a little bit physically, you have to think about going Biggio style on him and just changing positions and getting him over to third or another position where he can stay healthy, still be good, not wreck his knees, and not turn into a diminished player. He is young. He's 27, so that's good. And the thing about catcher, it's this very tricky balance, right, because the hardest position to get great offense in baseball is catcher. I mean, if you can have a guy who hits like Maurer who is a catcher, it's just a ridiculous advantage. It wouldn't be as big an advantage at first base or left field or whatever. This whole wins above replacement, it takes position into account, too. If you play a tough position like shortstop or catcher, you are inherently more valuable because you can do things defensively that guys can't. So there's that on one side. But on the other side, because it is physically demanding, you have to think about how you're going to manage this guy. So I think that a lot of this is going to depend on Twins trainers and the general manager and the manager having the presence of mind to know when to switch the guy. Maybe you go 4 years as a catcher and two at third and two at first, and he hits well throughout the contract. And it wasn't a bargain, but you got what you wanted out of him. But there is that risk. I agree with you about the catcher situation. The money thing is big. And you have to be careful, too. I mean, you can't – now they've set themselves up where they have that raise dilemma. They can't afford to make any other mistakes because they've locked down that much money with one guy. If they go get another guy for $10 million and he turns into Pat Burrell, that's a big problem for the Twins. So I think that's where it comes in. It's this opportunity cost issue. By the way, my buddy Rob Nyer at ESPN.com talked about this as well today. He said that is the biggest thing, that now the Twins can't make mistakes elsewhere. Great that they have a franchise guy, but be careful because if you go wrong elsewhere, you're in big trouble.
Yeah, I mean, you think like when the Yankees locked in A-Rod, yeah, maybe his body will break down a little bit. But ultimately, you pretty much know what you're getting for the 8 years. I didn't totally agree with the extension they did 2 years ago, but I'm talking about the initial. This one, I don't know. This worries me. I mean, I thought the team that would take the risk on paying a catcher this much money should be a team that has deep, deep, deep pockets. You know what I mean? It's like buying the house on, I don't know, Miami. That's like in the worst part for the hurricane. You'd be like, ah, screw it. It's an awesome house. If a hurricane knocks it down, I'll be fine. I'm a billionaire. This is like if the hurricane knocks down this house, you're done. There's no coming back. So I don't know. I don't know if I would have done it. I know what he means to Minnesota, obviously. I'm just saying, like, man, you're all in on this one.
I will say this, though. The one thing that people forget about, and it's a basic economics thing, is something called discount value, is that there's inflation, and there are things that go on with a long-term contract where if you say it's $23 million, $23 million a year means a different thing in 2010 than it does in 2015. It's still a buttload of money, but it's going to be less. It's going to have the appearance of being something like $18 or $19 million. Is that a lot of money? Yeah, but that defrays the risk a little bit. So there is that to consider too.
I have a counter for that.
Go ahead.
I don't think salaries have really gone up that much in the last 10 years. Like, look at the Manny contract that he signed with the Red Sox, $20 million a year for basically 10 years, and everybody was like, "Oh my God, where are salaries going to go 10 years from now?" Don't you think they've leveled off for the top guys to most degrees?
Two things. First of all, the Manny contract, and you could throw Denny Nagel and Mike Hampton and all the "I want to play in this city because they have a great school system" contracts.
Yeah.
That all happened in 2001 when everybody went completely crazy after the tech bubble and all these owners were crazy rich. So that's almost like an outlier. If you look at the natural progression of it and you almost throw 2001 out, they've been going up. They haven't been going up a lot, but they've been going up a little bit. So that's one. And two is, and this is the key, salaries are determined by revenue. Owners will pay whatever they can pay based on how much money they're bringing in. And revenue, baseball gets a little bit of a bad rap, and they say that, oh, the NFL is clearly surpassing, which I totally agree with, by the way. But baseball still makes money and continues to make money. They have MLB Advanced Media. They have all this stuff going on. And if the sport is making more money year after year, and it really hasn't suffered the same way that, basketball, we talk about what's happening in New Jersey and some of these places, it's horrible. Baseball's weathered the storm much better, and as the economy improves, and it already is improving, by the way, it's going to go better. So the Twins will be making more money 3, 5, 7 years from now, both in terms of stadium revenue, in terms of jerseys, and in terms of things like MLB Advanced Media, than they are now. So that's another factor to look at. So I almost turn it around, and I say, in fact, they're probably going to be in better shape later, not worse shape.
I'm going to turn it around the other way. I think the one shift that we've seen, it kind of mirrors what almost like a Hollywood movie. So the guys like Bauer and A-Rod and Pujols, Ryan Howard, those guys are going to get their money, and the contracts are going to be progress at the same rate they've progressed over the last 20 years. The ones that are changing is I don't think we're going to see those Vernon Wells-type contracts anymore. I think the days of people paying $127 million or whatever for somebody that doesn't sell tickets for your team, unless it's Yankees, Red Sox, Mets, I think those days are gone. We even saw it with Jason Bay. We saw it with Bobby Abreu. Like, that level of guy is just not going to get the same type of money anymore. I think Jason Bay would have made $120 million 5 years ago, and now he's in for 60.
But, Bill, wouldn't that imply to you that teams are in better shape, not worse? That means that they're not going to waste the big money on that contract. That means that they are going to spend $36 million on Jason Bay instead of $120. And that means that they're going to have more money left over for other guys. If they're not making the big investments and revenue streams, even if they're just stable, but let's say they're going up, that's good. I mean, I totally agree with you about your point. It's already happening in baseball. We're not seeing this middle class making tons of money. But that works out well for the owners. The what you call the ratio between how much teams are making in terms of revenue and what salaries are where they're going, it's actually working in teams' favors. I mean, salaries as a whole are kind of staying flat because of that contrast between the big guys and the little guys. Teams are making more. In fact, baseball players, in a way, are kind of more screwed than some other sports because of the way that ratio is going. Owners are making bigger profits than ever before because they've got smarter guys running the franchise who aren't throwing away money on Denny Nagel anymore.
So upper middle class is basically getting knocked out, but the elite upper class is still in good shape, and if anything, might be getting some of those upper middle class bucks, so even becoming more rich.
Yeah, and I think that's the case. You know, you mentioned Hollywood, but you can go to almost any industry, right? I mean, I don't have an expert opinion about the law or doctors or whatever, but I'm going to guess that if you're a superstar, you're probably making the money you're going to make no matter what you do. You're a widget maker, whatever. It's always going to work out. So that's fine. And I think that it's just consistent with running a smart business of any kind. And to wrap it back to the Rays for a second, these three guys didn't have great baseball experience. You know, Andrew Friedman, the GM, played ball at Tulane. And was a fine player and all this stuff, but, I mean, he didn't have a major league future. The other two guys, Silverman and Sternberg, they went with Goldman Sachs. And Friedman ended up starting his career at Bear Stearns. I mean, these are Wall Street guys who know how to build a business and know how to do things, I don't want to say on the cheap, but to get hidden value and not make the Vernon Wells mistakes, the equivalent mistakes on the stock market or in private equity or whatever. As you get more guys like that running baseball teams and not, you know, Dallas Green, who might be a fine baseball man, but isn't somebody who understands the complexities of running a $500 million business, I think you're going to see even more of that. We're talking about it now. 10 years from now, there might be zero contracts like that. So, you know, I think that's absolutely the case. And if anything, it'll accelerate because baseball is getting smarter. And by the way, I'd say that about basketball, too. You look at Pritchard and Presti and Morey. These guys are not necessarily 10-year NBA All-Stars. They're guys that are just smart people who happen to be running teams in a really effective way.
How do you see the way people discuss baseball players changing over these next 10 years? Like, for instance, RBI seems to be a stat that's just kind of going out the window. And you'll see some mainstream media people still talk about it. But I think there's been enough information now that it's just, it's a flawed stat. It's dubious. It's almost like plus minus in basketball. It's so dependent on your teammates and your situation that ultimately it doesn't really mean anything. I still think it matters a little bit just because, you know, if you're looking at guys' resumes over the years and you see somebody at 140 RBI or whatever, then that tells me, well, the guy was driving in runs and he was, more importantly, in a really good offense. So from that standpoint, it does give you information, but it shouldn't be something that we use to compare players, really. How mainstream do you think things like OPS Plus, BABIP, stuff like that, do you ever see that catching on?
To some extent, I do. It's interesting you mentioned RBI because that's like specifically my bailiwick. I was involved in a book a few years ago called Baseball Between the Numbers with the Prospectus guys. And like Nate Silver, who's now a political superstar, and Keith Wollner and James Click and all kinds of really smart, Stephen Goldman, all these really smart people were involved. And I wrote a chapter specifically talking about RBI, and I really just beat up on Joe Carter. And I said Joe Carter had this great career and all this stuff, but if you look at his stats, Joe Carter was pretty similar to Dave Kingman, which is something you'd be like, whoa, Dave Kingman, wow. But, you know, you could make that case. And what it comes down to is, if you're a very good player, you're almost certainly going to have a lot of RBIs because the team is going to be smart and say, we're going to bat you three or four. But having a lot of RBIs doesn't make you a very good player. And my favorite example is a guy named Tony Batista, who used to play a few years ago. Not a very good player. And he hit, again, I'm going to use an Expos example because that's the kind of homer I am, even though they're dead. He hit cleanup 1 year behind a bunch of guys who got on base, Jose Vedra and Brad Wilkerson and all these guys. And he played every day. He talked about durability. He played 162 games. And he hit, he drove in 110 runs. His on-base percentage was 276. 276 is like if you or I decided to go into Major League Baseball. It's that bad.
Right.
So, I mean, it just shows that if you have the opportunity, it was a rare example, but it shows that if you have the opportunity, something else can happen. I don't know that all these advanced stats are going to get adopted, but I'm most optimistic about something like wins above replacement or whatever derivative similar to wins above replacement. If you could tell me, I just signed Albert Pujols, the Red Sox won 82 games last year, now they're going to win 90, there is nothing simpler than that. There's no RBI to win stat, there's no this, there's no that. If you could just tell me this guy is going to win this many more games, that is the essence of the game. That is the simplest way to break down a player. I love it. I think it's a very easy to understand stat. And again, you don't have to know the input as much. It's more the output. You just know that based on everything that a guy does, he's worth two wins, three wins, all the way up to eight or nine for an elite player.
So you like that stat more than VORP?
I have to be careful here because I used to work for Prospectus, and that's a Prospectus stat. I would say that the thing about VORP is it doesn't take defense into account. Now, Prospectus has an all-inclusive stat, which is wins above replacement player, which is very similar to wins above replacement. It's just run on a somewhat different scale. There's a little bit the calculations are different, but they do the same kind of thing. And if you want to use that one, that works too. They're both great. I got no problems with either one. That's fine. And I think ultimately teams, you know, and you talked about this with Maury when you did the podcast with him too. They're not looking at things like plus minus or all due respect to John Hollinger, who I love. They're not looking at PER or things like that. They're looking at contextual stuff. And I think that in baseball, it's not as contextual a sport as basketball, but you're still going to see that to some extent. they need this type of player to win the pennant. They really need a number one starter or a third baseman or whatever. They're going to find that guy. And you talk about the Sox. It's not that Marco Scudero is the best player in baseball. It's that they needed a shortstop. There are fewer and fewer good players on the market. It turns out this guy could do some things pretty well. We're going to put him in there. Is he Pujols? No. Can he help us as one guy toward the push toward the pennant? Yeah, absolutely.
I wasn't a gigantic fan of that signing.
There was nothing else out there, by the way. I mean, the thing is that because teams are now signing Evan Longoria in the first year of his career, or Lester's locked up, all these guys, you just go out there. There's maybe five good guys on any given year. He was just the best guy out there. Were they going to trade Casey Kelly to go get some Edgar Renteria clone? Well, no. They would just go out and sign Scooter.
I just say, see, this has nothing to do with stats. This is just a personal thing.
Yeah.
Signing the guy who had the career year at age 35 always worries me. I'm just saying it worries me. I'm not saying he's not going to work out. I'm just saying I'm a little concerned. The guy had, let's see, I'm looking at him right now. He had over 400 at-bats four times in his entire career. And then went 592 in 2008 and 680 in 2009. And his last year's number, by far his best offensive season ever. I mean, his OPS was 789. He'd done over 701 once. So I'm just saying there's some red flags to me with this one. But not that
it's a good job. But I think it's priced into the contract. If they were signing him for huge money, I'd be
really
worried. But it's a relatively modest deal. And that's the thing to keep in mind. This is not a Vernon Wells deal. This is that kind of middle-class deal that might have been higher in years past and isn't so high now. There's no way you can tell me that CEO and Ben Cherington and all the people in the organization don't know what you just say. Absolutely.
Right.
Know that he's 35 and it's a career year. And they say, okay, for this much money, it's acceptable. It's not a pretty move to the naked eye, but it's fine as far as what they're trying to do.
Well, we also have the shortstop curse in Boston.
Yes.
The curse of Cabrera. It's how we
had
that. Huh?
He's an ex-Expo, by the way.
Yeah, I loved OC, and I will never, for the rest of my life, understand why we were so willing to get rid of him. There are always like weird stories about there were off the field reasons why he had to go. But all I knew is that the guy was great defensively and played with kind of personality and swagger that we needed post Nomar. Hey, we don't have a lot of time left.
Yeah.
Over unders. Let's get to the big stuff.
Yeah.
Baseball over-unders. Give us two that you like in the National League and then two that you like in the American League.
Definitely. By the way, I can go a little longer if need be, so no worries on that level. But okay, so first of all, the National League. In the NL East, the Phillies are overwhelming favorites. How overwhelming? The Braves, to win the division outright, are plus 350. That's huge. They were 86 wins last year, 87, something like that. A very good team, a very good pitching staff. Good up the middle guys, which to me matters a lot. Brian McCann, Yunel Escobar, just very good guys in that position, those positions. And they have a guy named Jason Hayward, who if you're just kind of a casual baseball fan, you don't know about this guy.
Mm.
He has broken several people's cars that were sitting 50 feet beyond the outfield fence in the parking lot this spring.
The baseball card nerds have gone insane over this guy.
Oh, my God. He's, I'm not even a Braves fan, and I'm drooling over him. He's
6'5",
240. If he starts the season in that lineup, and I think that he will, and Chipper Jones, I think, is going to, I don't know, burn down his house if it doesn't happen, burn down the general manager's house, the Braves become even more dangerous. Plus 350 for any team that projects to finish second in any division is very, very good. That just sets up very well. And the thing about, and again, this is only for gummy bear purposes, but let's say that, for example, that I like to wager gummy bears, I would look at it and I would say there's uncertainty in every sport. You can't just say this team always wins, therefore. Every dynasty ends. There's always bad luck. There's all that stuff. The Phillies are so well set up. I love Halladay. That acquisition is great. Their infield is ridiculous and all this stuff. But the Phillies have never had adversity. The only adversity that I would say they had was Brad Lidge. The bullpen was terrible last year. But they haven't had Ryan Howard go down for 50 games or Jimmy Rollins, something really bad happens to him or whatever. I'm not wishing it on anybody. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm just saying in life there's uncertainty. There's variance. And to have the kind of variance at plus 350, that sets up really well if you're a gummy bear wagering type of person.
All right, give me one more NL.
NL, let's see. See, I like to go ugly too. So I'd look at something like the Astros. So the Astros, I think, are projected for about 72 wins. And the Astros are so not a sexy pick. I mean, they're kind of old, and they have lousy players all over the place and all this stuff. But that means the baseline is that it's assumed they're going to lose 90 games, which is a lot in baseball. The thing about the Astros, and this is something that I've noticed, I've been doing this for a few years, and I often like to take teams that are projected 79, 81 wins, either over or under, because I think there's a lot of value and people don't pay attention to that stuff. is that the Astros are a team that will never, ever rebuild, ever. They're so stubborn. They're going to ride Roy Oswalt and Lance Berkman until they're 80 years old, just like they did with Biggio and just like they did with Bagwell, because the owner is just a stubborn SOB. He refuses. He will not do it. Drayton McClain will not let it happen. So if you have a team that's kind of bad but not terrible and they get to July and they don't trade any of their good players, that sets up well for them doing not too badly in the second half of the season. So depending on the odds that you're going to get, it could set up a value play if the Astros are, let's say, 71 wins to go over. Maybe they win 73. Maybe you're sweating right down to the last game of the season. But if you're getting close to even odds on a team that never, ever, ever rebuilds, and the Astros are almost a unique case, I like that wager very much.
And you forgot to mention the dramatic pickup of Pedro Feliz.
Feliz is going to change everything. There's going to be Feliz. It's going to be like Fernando Mania in Houston. That's
the stat heads don't like Pedro Feliz.
No.
Let's go with American League.
A couple. Number one, I'll play the homer card and point to the Tampa Bay Rays. The line that I saw, and by the way, now that we're saying this, of course these lines are all going to go haywire.
Yeah, I looked at your Atlanta line, and it's down to plus 225. So I think some people might have agreed with you, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, wait till the podcast comes out. That's not going to be good. But, I do like the Rays. Assuming that the Rays stay around the same level, which I've seen is about 88.5, if they were playing in a neutral division, I think there's almost no chance they wouldn't win 95 games. If they're playing in whatever, NL West, AL Central, they're just, to me, they're the third or fourth best team in baseball, maybe even better than that. They're right there with the Yankees, Red Sox, and Phillies.
I was going to ask you that. People love saying this, but it really, there's no counter to the fact that the three best American League teams are on the same division. There's nobody even close to those three teams, in my opinion.
I think on a neutral level, you're talking at least a five-win separation. And I do like some of the things that the Mariners are doing, and even the Rangers look a little frisky to me this season. But, yeah, I think that's true. And you talk about there's realignment being talked about and all this stuff. This is all very tricky, and part of what I'm writing about the book is just the Rays, the Orioles, and the Blue Jays have the single toughest situation of any three teams in any U.S. or North American major sport. They're totally screwed every single time because not only are they playing against the two toughest teams, by definition, there's only one wild card, so they need to beat the Yankees or the Red Sox or both every single season. It's really hard.
Well, yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine because we were talking about the Red Sox over-under, and the Blue Jays and the Orioles are going to be really bad this year. And I know they're...
I think the Orioles will be okay, but the Blue Jays will be terrible.
I'm not seeing the Orioles. I don't agree with you.
Well, it depends where they are. Again, if they're at 71 wins, I'm going over. If they're at 79, I'm going under.
I don't agree. I think they're going to stink. Let's say they stink. So you have two stinky teams in that division.
Yeah.
I mean, could the Red Sox go 30-8 against those two teams? Like, that seems conceivable, right?
It's definitely possible. I mean, there could be a letdown factor. It could be that they happen to catch the Orioles on a day when Lester is on the DL. Who knows? But, it's certainly possible.
Well, let's say they go 31-7 against those two teams. Not inconceivable, 30-8 or whatever. Then they basically have to play like 10 games over 500 against everybody else. And that's it. There's your 97 wins or whatever. And it just seems like, as you said, not only such a disadvantage for Baltimore and Toronto, but for the three, for Tampa, New York, Boston. Holy crap. You know, and obviously they have to play the Yankees, Red Sox. They have to go against those two, but you bat 500 against the other two teams, and then you clean up on Baltimore, Toronto. Pretty big advantage.
Yeah, I think so. And I think that the only wild card with the Rays is if something goes wrong, and again, I come back to variance and luck and all this stuff. If something goes wrong, the Rays are exactly the kind of team that would rebuild very aggressively. Last year, they were sort of on the periphery of the race, and they said, screw this. We could trade Scott Kazmir now. We're probably not going to win this year. Let's go get some guys who are pretty good, almost major league ready. They have a guy named Sean Rodriguez who could be a nice young power hitter for them, and we'll do it. And so what happened is the Rays kind of dove in the standings late in the year to where if you had an over-under that was around 87 or 88, you lost. They ended up winning 84 games. So that's the thing to consider. If the Rays are right there in July, they could win the World Series, but if they're not there, they could win 81 games. I mean, I think they're one of the most interesting teams in terms of which way it could swing of anybody because of the aggressiveness of that front office. So that's the only hedge that I would have on this bet. But in terms of talent, there's no question that they're better than 88 wins. Absolutely.
Why is Texas only 83.5?
Because they want us to win money. I don't know. I was actually, over the weekend, I was in Arizona. I'm writing a piece about the Rangers for, let's say, a significant publication that I used to read as a kid that I'm very excited about. I talked to all their front office people and all their people in the organization. And the cool thing that they're doing is This is a team that's going to be built, and it's crazy to say this, but on pitching and defense. This is another team that's adopting this rationale. And, you know, it's a park that is a big park. It's an offensive-oriented park, and it's not going to work out, at least superficially, on the level it does in Seattle. It won't look like they did as good a job. But think about what the Rangers have had over 20 years. When did they ever have a good pitching staff? We think of Pudge and Juan Gonzalez, and that's it. They've never had anything else. Now they got the kid Andrus at shortstop. Bourbon in center field is a great fielder. Kinsler at second base is pretty solid. All these up-the-middle guys are pretty good. They got guys who can catch the ball all over the field, and I think that's going to play well in that division. They've got a real good chance to do something interesting and maybe win the division outright. It's been a while, but I think this could be the year. And if not this year, their farm system is as good as anybody. They're another sort of sneaky team that maybe a year or two from now will be like, oh, we should have seen them coming, because they could be good for the next half a decade now.
Oh, I'm watching them. I'm seeing them coming. Because the other thing is they have, as you mentioned, they for once actually have some guys on their way up. And, you know, July 30th, if they need to make a move, they could go get somebody. They have guys that people want.
And that's Rangers. A division that's winnable. So if they're only on pace to win 83 games, which wouldn't be that good in the AL East, then you'd be rebuilding. In that division, you're saying, all right, let's go for it. Let's throw caution to the wind. They've got so many prospects that they can cash in. And if the Mariners are an 85-win team and the Angels are an 84, 85, or 86-win team, they can overcome that. So, again, it's all context. You know, the Rangers, you could say, on an absolute level, they're whatever, maybe about 82 or 83 wins. But if they're close, they're going to do X. That adds two or three more wins. Now I'm collecting gummy bears.
It's an interesting division because – Seattle, I think, is going to be good, although they're almost getting too much attention. And then the Angels, we've just learned not to count out the Angels. Like, whatever, they'll figure it out and somehow be good every year. Oakland's the only team that's going to stink. And actually, how do you see that playing out? I mean, is this the last year for them?
For Oakland?
Being in Oakland.
Oh, for being in Oakland. Well, Buster only just wrote about it today, I think. The Giants are basically exercising their veto power and not allowing Major League Baseball to move to San Jose. I think it could be one of those Peter Angelo situations where if you just cut someone a check, they'll go away. But until that happens, we don't know. And they should, you know, it pains me to say this because as an Expos fan, it was just so devastating. I mean, you have no idea, Bill. You talk about the pain of 86 years without a World Series. When you don't have a team, it's horrible.
Yeah.
Spring training, there's nothing to hope for. But, you know, Oakland to San Jose, it's not that bad. If you live in Berkeley or you live in Palo Alto or somewhere nearby, okay, so just drive a little further. It's not like they're moving to D.C. or whatever. So I think that they should move from that standpoint. I think that, again, push comes to shove, baseball will probably make it happen. If not next year, then sometime soon. Because obviously Mount Davis, that whole stadium, that's untenable. You can't do that.
Make a case for baseball in Montreal again.
I can. I'm emotional about it and all that stuff, but it's very difficult. I think that, number one, baseball would never, ever do that, and number two, I just think that the corporate sponsorship isn't there. That was always the problem, was when they were good. I mean, in the mid-90s, when they were, you know, it looked like they might win the World Series, went to strike and stuff like that, we were packing the stadium. I was still living there back then. It was packed. In the 80s, when they had Raines and Dawson and Carter, they were actually near the top of the league in attendance. In some years, they had better attendance than the New York Yankees did. That's how popular the Expos were. But so many things have happened. Corporate headquarters have moved away to Toronto or to New York or other places that you just don't have that support. It's not like, you know, your friends and my friends can say, let's go to the game, and that's going to do it. You need all this money behind the scenes that doesn't exist in that city anymore. So it's unfortunate, but I don't see it. I hate saying it, but that's the way it is. So I'll just have to just be a baseball fan as opposed to a fan of one team.
Your best AL pennant bet?
I still think Yankees. I just think that they have the advantage, and if they need something, they can go out and get it. The fact that they're sitting there and they're agonizing over whether Phil Hughes, who's a fantastic young pitcher, is going to be their number five starter, their eighth inning guy, or Jabba Chamberlain, who's a very good young pitcher, is going to be their fifth starter, their eighth inning guy. What other team can say that? I mean, that's ridiculous, you know. So I think that they have contingency plans. If X goes wrong, they can always do Y. So I don't think that they're a lock. I just think they're the best bet.
Well, Vegas would agree. They have them plus 140. Tampa is plus 600. Boston's plus 300. Any long shots here? Maybe Texas plus 1,200?
I'm a big believer that if you get into the playoffs, it's still a short series. And I don't think there's magic pixie dust or experience or this guy is more feared than that guy that happens in the playoffs. We saw it in 2008. As good as the Rays were that year, everyone's like, oh, they're going to fold. They don't have experience, blah, blah, blah. That's nonsense. The Angels have done it. The Diamondbacks have done it. The Marlins have done it. When you get into the playoffs, it's a short series. It's like a hot goalie, right? Give me Josh Beckett with the Marlins, and you go to the World Series. So if the Rangers or whoever, let's say the Twins, can win their division, they've got almost as good a shot as anybody. So if you're plus whatever, plus 1,200 or 1,500 to go to the World Series, That's crazy. In a way, I would much rather bet on a team from another division, stay clear of the AL East because there's so much nonsense going on, and three really good teams, and say, I'm going to back the Rangers or the Twins at these really long odds, do it, and if they get into the playoffs, now I got a chance to do something.
Well, the Twins are interesting because everybody's now writing them off because of Nathan, but if we've learned anything in this decade, it's you never know when another closer is just going to show up. You know, and, and the difference between Joe Nathan closing out 42 out of 45 saves versus some other guy that we don't even know who it is yet going 39 for 45, it's three wins. It's not like your season's over.
And you talked about the all-in factor. The Twins have it. The fact that they went out and got Tomei and Hudson, they never used to do that. They used to settle for playing Nicky Punto and guys like that, way too many at-bats or innings. They're not prepared to do that. They want to have a good team top to bottom, and they're already talking about trading for Heath Bell. And with the new stadium revenue and the fact that they signed Mauer and all this, I think it's more likely than not that they'll go out and trade for a closer, which, you could never say that about the Twins before. And I look at the rest of the division. It stinks, Bill. I don't like the White Sox. Everybody's talking about the White Sox.
I don't either.
And all this stuff. Eh, whatever. Tigers, eh, whatever. Royals, they're the Royals. You know, Indians, eventually they'll be good, but not yet. So, again, it comes down to competition. Maybe the Twins aren't so wonderful and perfect, but give me 85 wins and you're probably walking away with it.
Any National League semi-long shot you like for the pennant?
I still think that the Braves are a good bet. I think that's possible.
Plus 800.
Well, that's not bad. And I look at the West. I could concoct a bunch of scenarios for you where the Dodgers don't win that division. I think that the Rockies are very interesting this year. Ubaldo Jimenez is a fantastic. I mean, if you're a fantasy guy, you know all about him. But if you're just kind of, again, casual baseball fan, he's a beast. If he pitched in San Diego or Seattle, he'd be like 25-2 with a 2-point whatever ERA. He'd be ridiculous. He's unbelievably good. The rest of their staff's pretty good, too. Jorge De La Rosa and Jason Hamill and all these guys that nobody's heard of, they're all pretty solid guys. They've developed, again, pitching and defense. They do have hitting, but they've got other things going on, too. And don't forget, when they played against the Red Sox in the World Series that year, nobody saw them coming then, too. They have that same kind of team this year.
Reds at plus 1,300?
That's nice. That's pretty sweet.
What if the Cuban guy's like a stud? Who knows?
Yeah, that's right. That's exactly right. There's a lot of X factors. And I think that even if you want to go one deeper and talk about a super-duper sleeper, every single year the Statheads love the Diamondbacks. They say, well, Statheads love young guys. They're convinced that they're going to develop at a certain rate, and by the time they get to 26 or 27, they're going to be good. We know that some prospects flame out, but Stephen Drew and Chris Young and all these guys that keep disappointing us year after year, they're still young guys. And if they develop along with Justin Upton and those guys, and Danny Heron, I love him, he's one of the five best pitchers in baseball, and some of the pitchers they picked up this offseason, and that all goes well, and they're playing in a division where maybe the Dodgers come back a bit, and it's just an 86-87 win and play, who the heck knows? It's possible. If you can get into the playoffs, you've got a chance. I would bet that the Diamondbacks are even better odds than 1,300. I would put probably maybe, I don't even know, 2,000 or more.
Plus 1,300. I think there's been some action on them. Yeah. It doesn't seem it seems like 13-1 is about the max for some of these pennant bets.
Well, except for the year that the Rays won when they were 200-1.
Well, I think that's what changed it.
Turns out that people write books about stuff like that when it happens.
Yeah, I think the only real value you're going to get this year is a team like the Padres that obviously has no chance. Jonah Carey, a pleasure. Come on during the season.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate it.
All right, talk to you soon.
Target to sign off.
Whoa. Thank you for downloading the BS Report with Bill Simmons.
Too much fun.
Check out more podcasts at the iTunes Music Store or at PodCenter at ESPNRadio.com.
Peace out.
To thank you for making Subway footlongs famous, now enjoy any regular footlong as a $5 footlong. That's right, any, including your favorites like the savory chicken bacon and ranch. Any Subway regular footlong is just $5. Hurry in.